Cubberty on 2FM with Super Value Travel Insurance. Holidaying at home or abroad? Don't worry about a thing with Great Value Travel Insurance at supervalue.ie.
We are joined now by Philip Boucher-Hayes. Welcome, Philip.
Hello, good morning. How are you?
Very good. It's always good to see you, except for today, because the night we're about to talk about mass murders. But before we do that, and the horror of all that goes with it, I thought I had a good Omar Sharif story, and then I heard about yours.
Oh, do you have a good Omar Sharif story?
It was only in that he was on the Late Late Show with Jim Sheridan for the film festival. Jim and Omar for Sharif were doing.
Was this last summer, or
it was about a year ago in thereabouts? Yeah. And I was laughing because I was meeting my brothers for a pint, and I was saying to them, I felt like I had my one sort of Michael Parkinson passing story, saying, I'm going to afternoon tea with Omar Sharif in the Shelburne, you know, because I was. And I got to Shelburne to meet Omar Sharif, and we had the you know, afternoon tea, and then with Jim and Omar, and then Jim and Omar came on the TV show, and yeah, Omar Sharif was alive and well and a bit giddy, but I don't think probably 100% compos mentis, if you know what I mean. I mean that respectfully. He was probably...
He was in the twilight of his years by that stage, really.
He was, and I think he was teetering between coming and going a little bit in the sense of what we, I suppose, mental agility, if you like. Yeah. But great fun. Great fun, and wide open. And for all of that, you could see any time a woman appeared, the lights went even, you know, up the voltage.
And in the ladies too.
And
not,
the ladies, yeah.
Not just in him, because women's reaction to him of all ages. And it doesn't matter if you're talking about Dr. Zhivago era, Omar Sharif, or bridge playing 70 or 80 year old
Casanova.
Or Omar Sharif. Everybody seems so. Well, all the women seem to have had that kind of.
He had the thing. Mm. So what's your story? It's much more interesting.
It goes back to 2001. I was in Cairo because we were trying to figure out why it was that so many of the 9/11 hijackers had come from Egypt, and I was out playing cards with a bunch of journalists and losing very badly in an attempt to try and get information from them, when at the club that we were in, this guy walks in and walks past, and I said, God, that looks like the spit of Omar Sharif. Is it a bit racist of me to say that all Egyptian men look like Omar Sharif? And the guys I was playing cards with said, no, you fool, that is Omar Sharif. This is his regular watering hole. So I said, well, excuse me, gentlemen, I'm going to stop losing badly at cards to you and go and talk to Omar Sharif. And I went over and bought him a drink, sat down, started chatting, asked him would he, you know, consider giving RT an interview. And he did, and he was charm itself. Anyway, conversation after a while, after a couple of drinks, it started to get quite personal. But he has a for public consumption version of most of the stories. And he told me the story about how he was married to a beautiful Egyptian actress before David Lean made him a star in 1962 in Lawrence of Arabia. And he said, I went to Hollywood and there was all of these outstandingly beautiful women, and I knew it was only going to be a matter of time before I dishonoured my beautiful wife. So I came and I said to her, darling, we just cannot continue. I do not want to be dishonest to you. I do not want to bring shame on you and on our marriage, so we must divorce. And we divorced, and then he fixed me with this stare and said, and that was quite possibly the worst decision I ever made in my life. Why so? Well, because I never found the kind of happiness with anybody else that I had found with her. Now, I will have to admit at this point to being probably one or two gins beyond discretion. And I said, I nodded and said, yeah, that's very sad. But you did shag Julie Christie, didn't you?
Did you say that to him?
And he said, and I thought, oh God, I've overstepped the line here.
Yeah.
But then this smirk started playing on the side of his face.
For all of that,
he said, yes, I did, didn't I? Go get the champagne and I'll tell you how that happened.
I was only talking about Julie Christie at the weekend. What a cracker she was in her. Yeah, well, she
lucky
don't
old
look
Omar,
now.
Yes.
Yeah.
And lucky old Julie too.
Yeah, there were two winners in that equation. Anyway, what a good story.
Imagine what the children would have looked like.
Yeah. good news. Beaters. Good news. And it was somebody was saying you'd see in one of the papers today his coffin draped in a official sort of almost a wake or whatever the equivalent is in Cairo, and a leader in Cairo saying the country needs an Omar Sharif as a figure for their country, just to kind of gather around that is popular and positive rather than the sadness.
Rather than everything that's happening now. Absolutely.
Now, on a less on a more grisly note, we are here today to talk about different things, because people will remember a few weeks ago in Charleston in South Carolina, it was a 21-year-old guy called Dylan Roof, and he walked into a Methodist church and he shot 9 people dead. It was horrible news, obviously, but we thought we'd look at these sort of mass shootings and wonder, who are they? Why do they do it? And to an extent, where are they now? And Philip, you've been given the kind of unpleasant task of looking at it all, but let's talk about the commonality. What do they have in common with each other that draws them together?
When Dylan Roof went and did what he did, before we knew who was responsible, before an arrest had been made, you just kind of knew in your heart of hearts, didn't you, this guy's going to turn out to be white, he's going to turn out to be young, he's probably going to be from a middle class background, and he's probably going to be heterosexual. And yes, that's exactly what he was. So here you have somebody who's at the kind of the top of the socioeconomic pyramid, the least discriminated against group of people in the world, yet the vast majority of them are the people that dominate or populate the ranks of the mass murderers, the mass killers. And the Mother Jones, I don't know if you've ever read the Mother Jones online American website journalism of outstanding quality, but they have done some really, really excellent research in this area. And what they did was they took that kind of preconception that we all have of mass murderers being white guys, and they said, is that true? And they went back to 1982, examined 70 mass killings. Now, mass killing is where 4 or more people are killed and there isn't deemed to be a gang or a criminal element to it. But of those 70 mass killings since 1982, 44 of them were the murderers were white men in that group that I'm talking about. So that's 66%, and they do tend to be young as well. The average age is 35. So it's kind of perplexing. Why is it that this group that has the most going for it, the most privileged, are the ones who dominate this particular subset? And the thing, to come back to your original question, that they all have in common is that even if their ideology is different, if some of them hate women or if some of them hate Muslims or they hate school and school teachers, those are usually just the pegs that their bad intent is hung on, because the psychological and the behaviour profile in all cases is pretty much the same.
Is it? So that they'd have... What is it, a background thing? Is it a mental illness?
Having said that, let me immediately go and qualify it by saying that we also don't know in an awful lot of cases, because it's a really, really bad thing that and inevitably we end up coming to the point in these conversations where mental illness rears its head. But to make that association between violence and mental illness is a fallacy, because the vast majority of mentally ill people, I mean the vast, vast overwhelming majority of mentally ill depressed people, don't have the wherewithal to go and be violent. But there is a small subset that do. And again, Mother Jones broke down that figure of 70. Half of them had undiagnosed mental or untreated mental illness, but the other half had personality disorder. Just bad people, sociopaths, psychopaths.
And is it possible at all within that to know what the nature nurture breakdown is? I mean, that's, you know, do we look at their mothers and their fathers and their brothers and their sisters?
This is where we enter into the realm of total speculation, because so many of them kill themselves at the end, what they do, or if they don't kill themselves, they present law enforcement officers with no choice but to kill them. Suicide by cop. I think the figure of the 70 is 36 died at the scene.
So we will never know, obviously. Elliot Roger, Tell us about Elliot Rodger, the guy who's, he was what's called incels, which is a word I hadn't heard of before.
Yeah, Elliot Rodgers was obviously a very disturbed and ill person. He believed that his problem with the world was that he couldn't get laid.
Yeah.
As simple as that. He had this desperate craving for the validation that sleeping with a woman or having a girlfriend on his arm would give him. And he chatted on forums with other people who call themselves incels, involuntary celibates. I've looked at some of the chat forum stuff. You know, you just know that actually going out and having sex with somebody is not going to be a cure for their particular pathology.
Yeah.
Their anxiety is going to transfer on to something else. But anyway.
And also, there are so many guys who can't, you know, meet somebody for whatever reasons and are indeed involuntary celibates, but they don't go out and buy a gun and they just sit at home, watch Netflix and troll. So
absolutely. And there are so many people who hate Muslims, who hate Jews, who hate school teachers, who never take action.
Okay, so this guy is obviously at the extreme end of it. Elliot Rodger couldn't meet a girl, took it upon himself to take what, revenge on women or
on women. On womankind, yeah. Generally. So he went out, killed six people in Santa Barbara in California. This is about 2 years ago now. But obviously, women weren't his problem. His problem was he was ill, yes, but also this sense of entitlement that seems to come up because, you know, I said that these guys are all at the top of the socioeconomic pillar, or many of them are, and they have a sense of entitlement to, I should not be in a position where I see black people taking jobs or being as wealthy as I am because I am a heterosexual young white male. I should be the alpha male. I should be the top of the pile.
As per Dylan Roof, yeah.
Yeah, as per Dylan Roof, as per Jared Lochner, as per Eric Harris in Columbine. In fact, now there's a good one to talk about. Look at the two different profiles. Dylan Klebold and Eric Harris were the Columbine High School murderers. And they come from either end of the spectrum because poor old Dylan Klebold was just straightforward depressed. In what he wrote about and what he spoke about, it was fairly obvious that he saw death as a place of tranquility. And that suicide for him was going to be an end to the suffering that he was enduring. Unfortunately for him, and even more unfortunately for all the high school kids in Columbine, he came into the orbit of this nasty piece of work, Eric Harris, who had an extinction fantasy. People who have an extinction fantasy generally have a superiority complex and like to entertain the fantasy or the notion that they would at some point be the last person left
standing
on Earth.
Yeah,
yeah. And usually after they have exterminated pretty much everybody else. So
you have this kind of anti-chemistry or this unpleasant influence that he might have on him.
As he did on Klebold. He manipulated Klebold and groomed him for their crime over the course of many, many months. And poor old Klebold just did not have the wherewithal to resist Harris's attention. And that, again, is something that comes up when you look at the guy, Adam Lanza, who was responsible for the Sandy Hook Elementary School murder. Oh, that was absolutely horrendous. And Adam Lanza was a number of different things going on and going wrong with him there. But he had taken to his room. He had put black bin liners all over the bedroom windows and the computer room windows. He would only communicate with his mother by email. And even when they were in the house together. But he too seems to have had this sense of entitlement that the world had cheated him. He had just descended in his psychosis into a place where he could not tell up from down, left from right, day from night, and ultimately right from wrong. Absolutely fascinating. I bumped into a year or so ago, one of the psychiatrists who treated Anders Behring Breivik, Utøya Island murderer,
the Norwegian spree, that awful thing.
And what was really contentious about that particular one was that you remember when the initial psychiatric assessment was done on Behring Breivik, they said he's mad, he's insane, he can't stand trial. But then the guy that I met was part of a second team of psychiatrists who assessed him some months later, and they said, no, he is actually perfectly sane. He can stand trial and should be legally responsible for what it is that he's done. And I said, how can that be? How can somebody be, you know, insane and then suddenly sane? They said, well, at that time, he was in the grip of a psychosis. Behring Breivik was somebody who had a personality disorder. He was a sociopath. He retreated from the world because he couldn't make the connections with people that he was trying to make. He retreated from the world and created this own fantasy world for himself. And he was still, at the time that he surrendered himself to police, he was in the grips of this psychosis. But as several weeks of interaction with lawyers and policemen and doctors went on,
he
came down off it. And he revealed himself to be sane, not normal, still utterly convinced of the rightness of his actions and what he had done, but he most probably would not have done it again in that state of mind. And that thing about connections, and because we don't, we say, look, these guys are all, they must all just be loners.
Or loners, certainly.
Dangerous loners. They're actually people, I would imagine, who have failed to make connections or trying to make connections with people, with girls, with authority figures, and constantly get rebuffed. And it's that social rejection that ends up prompting them down the road that they went. You know what, again, it was about 2003, it wasn't the Middle East, actually, sorry, it was in Iraq. I ended up going to a prison in northern Iraq where the Kurdish Peshmerga had captured alive three guys who were intent on suicide bombing, and I wasn't there to interview them, but I actually ended up being able to talk to these guys through a translator in the prison. And my overriding impression of these young men who had been sucked into a death cult and convinced that it was a good idea to go and kill themselves and many others around them was that they had been spurned by a woman, they had been rejected socially, that they were just awkward
misfits.
And not misfits. Able to. Well, again, that doesn't do misfits much of a favour either, because it suggests that...
I know, they were just a bit out of sorts, but obviously the extreme end of it. Why didn't they just take a gun, put it in their mouth and blow their brains out? Why do they have to go and share the bullets with all these other victims then and make a big statement? Is it a fame thing? Is it a cry for help in the sense for... is it a cry for attention? Why not just say, I'm out, bang, finish it off?
Notoriety seems to be a part of the pathology people hear. People who have this level of aggression want to make some kind of an impact or statement against the world that they have such a problem with. Certainly that was Eric Harris of Columbine's fame's desire. He wanted to shape the world that he was going to leave behind him and achieve some kind of notoriety. So it's not necessarily X Factor kind of culture of celebrity of fame. But that said, there is also a worrying phenomenon that psychiatrists and psychologists have noted, that every time one of these incidents happens, within 2 weeks there is a greater risk or an increased chance of something similar happening. And the statistics bear all of this out, and they are just straightforward copycat people. People who have said, God, my pain, my agony, my problems with the world might be solved for me if I take the same route that this guy did. And this is where we in media have a really big part to play in this, and we are a very significant part of the problem. As we speak right now in Paris, two gunmen are holding 10 people hostage in a Primark. Twitter ever reliable source of information tells me that for sure they are either definitely Muslim terrorists or they're just straightforward criminals. Speculating is absolutely useless, pointless. But there are some hard and fast rules that psychiatrists have pointed to for how these things should be covered by media and what we should and we shouldn't be doing. The first thing that you shouldn't have is a news report that starts with sirens. And I can guarantee you, 9 o'clock news tonight, that is what we're going to see. The second thing, if, God forbid, what has happening in Paris does end up in fatalities, you don't put the body count at the top of your story. Because again, that is giving the people who did this the validation that they are seeking. You don't go for 24-hour rolling news coverage of an unfolding hostage situation, because sure as damn it, they're watching inside and that is giving them the kick and the notoriety that they want. You don't portray the killer as some kind of a black combat clad anti-hero.
Beast.
Because again, that is the kind of notoriety somebody with this deep-seated aggression wants.
You're describing every news bulletin we've been watching for the last 2 years.
What you do, what should be done is, if there are victims to a story, you concentrate on them. You focus in on the parents in Sandy Hook in Newtown. You focus in on the parents standing on the mainland of Utoya Island wondering what's happened to their kids. That's the story that you tell.
It's a lovely aspiration, but you try telling a newsroom editor that in any medium and they'll say, I'm sorry, but that's just not going to do the job for us.
You are unfortunately absolutely right.
Philip A. Trace, thank you for this intriguing look at that grisly world. But thanks for coming in today. No doubt you have an assignment for later on.
No, I'm Joe Duffy now.
Oh, you're Joe this afternoon. Okay.
For the next 3 weeks. Talk to Phil.
Good luck, Phil. Thank you.